Welcome to this episode of our special podcast series, a collaboration between ASTCT Talks and Cancer Network. In each episode, we dive into the latest developments and challenges in the treatment of multiple myeloma, T-cell malignancies, and other pivotal topics in oncology, hematology, stem cell transplantation, and cellular therapy. Join us as we speak with leading experts, uncover new research insights, and tackle key issues facing healthcare professionals today.
Thank you for joining us today. My name is Terry Lynn Schigel. I'm a clinical pharmacy specialist at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center with our stem cell transplant and cellular therapy department, and I will be moderating today's episode, which will be focusing on pediatric CAR-T, focusing in ALL from clinical trials to real-world practice. And our guest today is Vinita Pai. Vinita, could you please introduce yourself?
Yep. First off, I want to thank you as well as Cancer Network Oncology On The Go, as well as ASTCT Talks to, you know, giving me this opportunity to share my expertise. I am a faculty at the College of Pharmacy at Ohio State University. I've been here for about 25 years. 23 of those have been spent in taking care of pediatric bone marrow transplant patients, mostly exclusively with that team at a nearby hospital, Nationwide Children's Hospital.
Wonderful. Well, we're so glad to have you here and to learn from your experience with transplant and now cellular therapy, as you know, the landscape is really changing with the patients that we're taking care of on our services. So with that, why don't we go ahead and dive, or I like to say drive, into today's episode discussing CAR-T journey in pediatrics. I think I'd be remiss if I didn't start by sort of reminding everybody how far we've come, right? The development of CAR-T cell therapy really spans about three decades, from the initial proof of concept in the late 1980s to the first FDA approval, which is almost 9 years ago now, August 30th, 2017, of tisagenlecleucel for pediatric and young adult relapsed refractory B-ALL patients, specifically those less than or equal to 25 years old. And then, you know, since 2017, the FDA has approved a total of 6 CAR-T products across 6 hematologic malignancies, and 4 of those are targeted on CD19, which will be our main focus today, and then 2 targeted against BCMA for multiple myeloma. But I think with that being said, in such a short period of time with having so many products, tisagenlecleucel remains the only CAR-T product available for pediatric patients, really highlighting the significant gap in the pediatric-specific development, despite it, as I mentioned, being the origin in pediatric patients. So I think it's going to be really exciting to discuss how far we've come, you know, more from not the inception of CAR-T, but really the last 9 years since the FDA approval with Vinita during this podcast. So I'm going to go ahead and kick us off with the first question. So, you know, Vinita, how do outcomes compare in real-world practice now versus that initial pivotal clinical trial? And what does long-term follow-up data tell us about durability of response and survival?
And I think these two questions are probably rolled into one answer. And as I go through, I may frequently refer to tisagenlecleucel as tisa-cel. Or CD19 CAR-T. And so my intent is to mainly talk about CD19 CAR-T in the space of B-cell ALL, pediatric, young adults, children. So in addition to the pivotal ILIANA trial, there are 2 other groups that have tracked real-world data for tisa-cel after it was marketed. And the 2 groups are, the one is the Pediatric Real-World CAR Consortium, which has data on about 185 patients. Then the other group is the CIBMTR cellular therapy registry data. That's the largest patient population. And then the ILIANA trial also published their 3-year update. They have a median follow-up of about 39 months, small patient population, though they started with 75. At this time, they have about 39 patients. But what's interesting is that across those 3 trials, some of the numbers are very comparable. So if you look at the overall response rate in all 3 trials, it's been ranging between 81 to 86%. And that day 28 MRD negative status has ranged anywhere from 95 to 99%. So if you look at ELIANA and the CIBMTR registry data, if you look at their relapse-free survival, which is what we want to know at this point, how many are going to relapse and how many will be okay without any further therapy. Unfortunately, you know, it is at about 50% at 24 months if you look at the CIBMTR data, and comparably at 52% in the ELIANA trial, which is at 36, a follow-up of about 36 months. If you go back and look at the Pediatric Real-World Consortium data, they have their relapse-free survival at 12 months, which is about 62%. So I think they know they seem very comparable. And so the, I think the big point for me here was, I know that, you know, I was there at the inception of tisa-cel at our hospital, and there was so much hype and so much expectation of the paradigm shift. And I'm sure it has shifted the paradigm. But then again, what is a little frustrating to me is that at 24 to 36 months, half of the patients will be in remission without any continued therapy, but there's the other half who's going to relapse. And what are the reasons for relapse? And secondly, what can we do differently so that we can, you know, make these numbers look a little bit better? Yes, it's been a paradigm shift, but I was hoping for much better results than 50%.
I think to your point for, you know, being the first product, it's maybe a great first start. But when you think about who has that durable response, who do we maybe not have to immediately go and think of transplant as like a salvage therapy or, you know, CAR T to transplant? Who has those pre-infusion factors and maybe post-infusion biomarkers that are associated with that durable remission after, you know, receiving the CD19 CAR T?
There are a few things that would be worth talking about. One is the cytogenetics itself, which do not bear that much importance when we are thinking about CD19 directed therapy. Next is going to be prior exposure to blinatumomab, which is a CD19 directed therapy. And it has been seen that if you have no response to blinatumomab, which is usually used in phases before you come to CAR T, this can predict inferior response rate and decrease event-free survival when you move on to CAR T. So no response to blinatumomab is bad news. And then right at the time of infusion, or right before the infusion of CAR T, what would be those factors? First of all is if you have high disease burden, which has been defined as greater than or equal to 5% blasts in the bone marrow, that is associated with high risk of relapse. If you have active extramedullary disease at the time of CAR T infusion, you may be at increased risk, mainly because the CAR T cells, depending on where that extramedullary site is, may not be able to penetrate. Another factor would be, what is your CD19 antigen load? Because if you have a high load, that means you have a lot of leukemic cells, doesn't bode well for some of the acute toxicities. Then lastly, the lymphodepleting chemotherapy. As we started with CAR T, I know that there were different lymphodepleting chemotherapy combinations used and actually different drugs being added. I think at this point, I can say that the standard lymphodepleting regimen should be a combination of cyclophosphamide, 500 milligram per meter squared per day for two doses, and then fludarabine, 30 milligram per meter squared per day for 4 days. However, there are two recent retrospective studies that show that there is a correlation between fludarabine exposure, and here we're talking about area under the curve, and relapse risk as well as CAR T persistence. So the magic area under the curve is greater than 13.8 milligram R per liter. And then there are some studies that are telling you that there is a therapeutic window of between 13.8 and 25 milligram R per liter. And this has been, or achieving this area under the curve has been found to be a little problematic in specific pediatric patients, because that one dose fits all doesn't really work for pediatrics. And then it doesn't work as you get into the lower ages or the lower body weights. And so we can talk a little bit more about it subsequently. But that's another factor that's going to affect whether your lymphodepleting chemotherapy was intense enough to get rid of the existing host T cells, because you do not want them to then attack the incoming CAR T cells. That's going to result in lack of expansion right off the bat.
Absolutely.
Some of the post-infusion biomarkers, I think, that predict you're going to relapse is going to be, first is B-cell aplasia. Now, I say it's a soft biomarker mainly because it's not really reliable, because you can have relapse and yet still be in B-cell aplasia, especially if you're going to have a lineage switch. Then B-cell aplasia means nothing if you're going to switch your lineage from ALL to AML. Secondly, the detection of MRD, minimal residual disease. If you are MRD positive by next generation sequencing at day 28, and then you repeat it at 3 months, you are at high risk for relapse, because that bodes that there is very short CAR T persistence. So I think these would be the big factors that can help us decide, should we be ready, get ready for a consolidative allogeneic transplant after CAR T, and should I use CAR T as a bridge to this allogeneic transplant? We know that about 50% of the patients are going to be okay. They are going to remain in remission without any additional chemotherapy.
Absolutely. And as you astutely pointed out, focusing on the post-infusion biomarkers, is we do have more sensitive tests now than when these trials were initially ongoing. And so what will the utility of ClonoSeq be, and what is that level of detection to decide, you know, what therapies you may or may not need to do after receiving the CAR T? And that is also a discussion we frequently have in adults. So I'm highlighting there is some overlap. Before we, you know, move on to maybe some more pediatric specific practical challenges, one question I did have is, in these landmark trials, there's often a population that's left out just because of their presentation or their risk factors. And so for those patients, you know, not represented in the Alenia trial specifically, what have we learned about outcomes in those groups?
So if we were to look at the pivotal Ileana trial, they excluded a few groups. They excluded children who are younger than 3 years of age. They excluded children who had Down syndrome, and then patients who had isolated CNS involvement. Patients who had isolated extramedullary disease were excluded, and then patients who had less than 5% bone marrow blasts. So majority of the patients in the Ileana trial actually had a disease burden of approximately 75%. So if you look at children that are younger than 3 years of age coming to CAR T, they're probably diagnosed with B-cell ALL long before they're 3 years of age. Some of them may be diagnosed in their infancy, so less than 1 year of age. So infant ALL, as I said, is an extremely aggressive disease, high incidence of relapse, poor survival rate, especially those that have that KMT2A rearrangement. Data is sparse in this patient population. So there are about two studies, both are low numbers, N of 14, N of 35. The median follow-up is only about 10 to 14 months there. The day 24 MRD negative CR ranged from 64%, which is in the 14, the number N is about 14 for that, to 84%. But if you compare this to any of the other trials that had all patients, they achieved a MRD negative CR of 90% and higher. And so here you see that it is relatively lower at 64 to 84%. The event-free survival at 12 months is about 67%, which looks much better compared to the 50% in the Ileana trial, as well as the real-world CAR consortium in pediatric patients. Overall survival at 12 months is 84%, compared to about 72 to 76% in the Ileana and the real-world CAR consortium trial. So the day 28 MRD looks bad, but at least at 12 months, 67% are alive. Again, as I said, very limited data, mainly because this is considered one of those rare infant disorders. The next is Down syndrome. So Patients who have Down syndrome or children who have Down syndromes are almost 10 to 20 times more likely to develop ALL. Not only that, that when we treat them, they're going to experience increased treatment-related morbidity and mortality compared to the other ALL kids that don't have Down syndrome. Event-free survival and overall survival numbers are pretty abysmal, significantly lower in this patient population compared to ALL population that does not have Down syndrome. Again, I have some data from the early phase trials of tisa-cel. Again, very small numbers, 16 patients aged between 5 to 22. Overall response rate is about, at 3 months, was 88%, very comparable to the Eliana trial and the real-world consortium. MRD negative complete response was at 75% compared to the 90% in the other trials. At 3 years, only 38% of these patients remained in remission compared to the 50% that you would see in the Eliana trial. So again, the data is not that encouraging. The Pediatric Real-World CAR Consortium had a subset analysis which had 47 patients who were Down syndrome. And the data when they did the univariate analysis compared to the overall population, the patients that had Down syndrome had improved relapse-free survival and overall survival. So that's a little encouraging given that it's 47 patients compared to the 16, but yet not large numbers there. But those two groups of pediatric patients still remain in need of better therapy. Definitely the infant ALL group, and there are studies that are in Europe as well as in the UK, where they are actually adding CAR T as part of the therapy to prevent them from having to go to transplant, because transplanting someone that is, 1 to 3 years of age is going to cause significant long-term toxicities.
Yeah, those are all great points. So as you pointed out, the numbers are small, but it's good that there is some being reported so that we can learn and focus on those pediatric populations. So I think that will help us transition nicely to just some practical challenges or considerations specifically with pediatrics. I know I only practice in the adult setting, so I'm learning a lot already through this discussion. And one of the questions I do have with, I guess, logistical barriers to getting a pediatric patient through the CAR T process from apheresis to infusion, what are the biggest challenges that you face in that space?
I think most of the logistical barriers that we'll see in the pediatric population are comparable to those that we may see in young adults and even in adult patients, mainly access to CAR T therapy, financial barriers, their location from the nearest center that offers CAR T. I think where pediatrics will stand out is the whole process of leukapheresis, because, and especially among the pediatric population, there's one group. Again, it may seem like I'm harping on the less than 3 years of age, but they offer a unique challenge, mainly because they are so little, and you have to place big honking apheresis catheters in order to collect the cells. And so it's not always possible that their little veins can support the size of those apheresis catheters. And that's, I think, one of the biggest challenges is the difficulty in leukapheresing them and then manufacturing, mainly due to patient size. But the caveat to that is one needs to anticipate that we may need more than 1 day of collection. And again, when I say that, it also depends on whether the surgical team at that institution has the expertise to put that leukapheresis catheter in such small patients. So it's not just the body weight, but also some expertise. Or are they willing to take the risk of putting the catheters in these patients? And then there is the risk that you may put a catheter in it, they tolerate it, you collect. Despite adequate collection, something may go wrong during the manufacturing process. and then it may not be successful, which begets repeat leukapheresis. And so I think that is the biggest challenge. If you look at just one big thing that you would think about pediatric patients, and the logistical problem would be in the smaller patient population. There are specific recommendations on how to deal with small size patients when they are being apheresed to optimize collection. I think first the recommendation is that they need red blood cell transfusion to maintain their hematocrit at about 40%. Secondly, you need to put a central venous catheter in for collection. Before the collection starts, the circuit needs to be primed with blood. And then the infant needs to be protected from hypothermia. Those would be the big things that may push us into optimizing collection in children who are less than 10 kilo body weight.
Excellent points made, and definitely different considerations, although I would say amongst all patients, you worry about getting adequate leukapheresis to manufacture a product, but different considerations for your little babies compared to my Texas-sized adults over here. I know you briefly mentioned it when we were talking about considerations for durability of response when thinking about the lymphodepletion chemotherapy and specific pediatric considerations. Do you mind expanding upon that a little bit more? And then just to piggyback off of some pharmacokinetics you had mentioned with fludarabine, although we think that's interesting and applicable, I guess, how do you use that in the real world setting, and can you or do you yet? So,
right. So let's look at not so real world scenario. So as I mentioned earlier, there were two retrospective studies. In 2025, the pharmacy group at St. Jude's published a study where they are recommending age-adjusted dosing of fludarabine for lymphodepletion versus what they call is fixed dosing. So the fixed dosing is the 30 milligram per meter squared per day for full days. And this is based on their simulation. So it's not that they actually did this in real time, but retrospectively, they're looking at the data and predicting what would be the best case scenario for best outcomes. So in the simulation, the category is less than 6, 6 to 11, and then 11 to 15, and then greater than 15. So only 22 to 61% of those patients are going to achieve an AUC that's greater than 13.8. That's a really wide range. So if you look at specifically within the pediatric group, patients who are less than 6 years of age, greater than 50% of those patients ended up with subtherapeutic area under the curve. And on the other side, the patients who were greater than 15 years of age would end up with an AUC that's higher than 25 milligram R per liter if you use the fixed dosing strategy. And this was, again, I need to reiterate that this was through simulations using pharmacokinetic modeling. Now, they do recommend age-adjusted dosing. And so in the context of less than 6 years who were more than 50% were subtherapeutic, they're recommending increasing the dose from 30 to 37 milligram per meter squared per day, four doses, so that you put the patient into this range. And then the next group is slightly higher at 32. And for the 15-year-olds and higher, they're actually recommending a decreased dose to about 26 milligram per meter squared. So if you use their age-adjusted dosing, they found on their simulations that 75% of the patients would achieve an AUC within the therapeutic range. And then if you actually did therapeutic drug monitoring and then adjusted your doses based on that, you are going to achieve that therapeutic window in about 94% of the patients. So from all this, we would assume that the best case scenario for our patients is we need to do therapeutic drug monitoring for our fludarabine and adjust doses like we do for busulfan. Now, the real world problem there is, and at our institution and even across the street where there is the Ohio State University, the James Cancer Center, which is adult doing maybe, 1,000 transplants a year, even they do not have the ability to do in-house fludarabine PK monitoring. So it would have to be a send-out. We don't even do busulfan here. we send our busulfan to Seattle to Fred Hutchinson. And so we are not able to adjust doses in real time. So that's, I think, going to be the biggest challenge to achieve that 94% patients in the therapeutic range is we would have to have a lab close by that could do the levels and turn around and give you the results by the time the next dose is due. We may not be able to adjust every dose. So for those that don't have that, should we be doing age-adjusted dosing? Now, they also had some pharmacodynamic relationships with this PK data, and they saw that if you at least use age-adjusted dosing or therapeutic drug monitoring, what's going to happen is that the number of patients that are going to achieve overall survival at 24 months is going to increase by 67%. And you'll be able to reduce the cumulative incidence of relapse at 12 months by about 72%. So now, again, my caveat to this is all simulations. So I think, one, we need more prospective data to confirm that this clinical situation actually fits very well in real life. As we see more model-informed precision dosing for a lot of our conditioning regimen, I think the biggest limitation is not all centers are going to be able to do PK in real time and may have to rely on the model-informed population pharmacokinetic parameters. But even that requires you to have a platform that is able to do it for you, that you can punch in your patient numbers and it can spit out the information for you. And those platforms are a bit expensive to and may not be available to all pediatric centers.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as you pointed out, I would say across all patient populations doing chemotherapy, you know, therapeutic drug monitoring in real time always poses a challenge. And so with this simulation paper, how do we move forward, you know, integrating it into future prospective trials so that we can, you know, have proof of concept beyond the retrospective simulation, I think would definitely be interesting. So with that, I'm going to pivot us into toxicity management and discuss pediatric considerations with how you manage cytokine release syndrome or CRS and immune effector cell neurotoxicity syndrome or what we call ICANS now and how that has really evolved in the pediatric patient population over the last several years.
I remember when we first onboarded Tisa-cel, we were so obsessed about making sure that they did not get tocilizumab, that they did not get steroids, especially the steroids part, unless they absolutely needed it. We, you know, put in best practice alerts to tell providers, don't give steroids because they are receiving CAR T. And I think we have come away from that obsession a little bit, I want to say, definitely with relationship to tocilizumab. As far as steroids are concerned, I think we are still a little bit touchy about giving it, you know, at the drop of a hat and considering using it if we absolutely need it. The big difference between a pediatric and adult, I think one would be grading. So the grading is no different, with the exception of, I think, for ICANS, because anyone that is less than 12 years of age, we use the Cornell assessment of pediatric delirium, because not everyone is going to be able to write a standard sentence or be able to, you know, tell you that they're oriented to time, like four orientation strategies. The management is usually very similar. So we follow what the guidelines are. The drugs may be a little different for, you know, like the vasopressors may be different or when we give it. And again, most of our doses are on a milligram per kilo basis. But what I was, as I was preparing, what interested me was that there is this whole concept of preemptive treatment of CRS and ICANS. Again, data is very, you know, small patient population. And well, for a change, the studies that I'll talk about, both pediatric studies. So the first one is where tocilizumab was used preemptively. The patients who received this preemptive tocilizumab, their incidence of grade 4 CRS was about 27%. We're talking about an N of 26 here. compared to a historical cohort group that had the same tumor burden, but did not receive tocilizumab. And that N was about 50 patients. And in those patients, grade 4 CRS was seen in about 50% of the patients. So it was much higher. And so the whole theme here is, can we prevent some of these acute toxicities from escalating into severe toxicities? Keeping in mind that we do not want the anti-tumor efficacy of the CD19 CAR T to be impacted. And this study looked at that particular aspect too, and did not see any change in the efficacy. So overall response rate, 24-month probability of event-free survival, overall survival were similar between the patients who got preemptive tocilizumab to that historical cohort group. So there is some relief there that we probably won't affect the anti-tumor efficacy. Another study was where tocilizumab and corticosteroids, so dexamethasone, were given sequentially. What they did was they were sequentially started with tocilizumab. If they still seemed like they continued with mild CRS proceeding to life-threatening, they would then give a dose of dexamethasone. And what they saw was in the patients that received sequential toci corticosteroids, the grade three and greater CRS was only about 30%. Grade three was 30% in the patients who did not receive the early intervention. So compared to the 15% in those who received. So almost double the number of patients did develop grade three CRS. Again, no negative impact was seen on the efficacy of the CAR T cell therapy. Now, a note of caution here is that the intervention with tocilizumab and or dexamethasone occurred after the clinical signs of CRS, which we would think are the clinical signs of CAR T cell expansion. So one has to be careful. It is not necessarily prophylactic, but it is more preemptive. In the context of ICANS, I did not find any data that was directly related to CD19 CAR T used in pediatric or young adult B-cell ALL. There was a phase 2 trial, adult patients that received T-cell, but for lymphoma, anakinra dosing actually reduced the rates of both any grade ICANS as well as grade 3 and higher ICANS. Not pediatric data, not in relationship with B-cell ALL.
So, yeah, I think just to touch upon what kind of affects all patient populations will hopefully be more specific to you as you get more CAR T indications, is not all underlying diseases are the same. Not all CAR T products are the same. So really looking at the co-stimulatory domain when maybe deciding the most appropriate preemptive treatment or treatment of CRS and ICANS, and then learning from real world experience and getting more comfortability and when you will introduce these therapies, knowing that we're probably not affecting the CAR T the way we were initially concerned with when these trials were ongoing. You know, something that we consider in all patients that get cellular therapy, but I think even more so in children and young adults, is those long-term toxicities and survivorship considerations, because we hope that they live well beyond the treatment that they receive into their adult and late years. And so could you comment on some considerations and, you know, the long-term safety profile in our pediatric and young adults receiving CAR T therapy?
Based on, at least at our institution, as well as based on what I looked for, there are no standard assessment measures for late effects following CAR T, not in adults, not in pediatric patients. There is some, I think, guidance from the FDA, but that is in the realm of gene therapy. And it's mainly based on the viral vector that you're going to use to transduce the CAR cells. And so depending on what that the vector is for lentiviral, the recommendation from the FDA is that there needs to be at least a 15-year follow-up. And in that follow-up, they have this loose recommendation of needing to design features or measures to look at new malignancies that may develop, and then looking at new onset or exacerbation of a previously existing neurological, rheumatological, or autoimmune disorder. So I don't think all of them could be applicable to PEDS, but and then on top of that, any hematologic disorder. So that would be the cytopenias as well as the B cell aplasia that we see. And then if they have any new incidence of infection, which again is seen in our TISA cell patients, mainly because cytopenias, neutropenia can be prolonged and it can go on for years. And then B cell aplasia, if it is, and you need B cell aplasia because that means you're in remission, your immune reconstitution is compromised. And so you are at increased risk for earlier bacterial infections and then later on viral infections. Now, one could use the COG, Children's Oncology Group, long-term follow-up for survivors of childhood cancers guidelines. And then you can take the CIBMTR late effects form, which is mainly for transplant. The COG is mainly for those patients that receive chemotherapy. None of these are for CAR T. And even the FDA recommendation is for gene therapy. We could take all of these together and cobble together guidelines because I did not find any that were very instructive. They keep talking about, at least in adults, I think they want to look at cardiovascular toxicity, neurological, as well as GI. In the pediatric population is going to be significantly different, given that some may be starting treatment at 3 years of age. Some of them may actually get a, you know, post-CAR T transplant. So physical and neurocognitive development all through that, sexual health or sexual dysfunction in their adolescence, and then fertility issues as they become young adults. So that's something that probably is going to be standing out compared to the adult patient population. Now, talking specifically about secondary malignancies, there is a FDA black box warning. So the most recent study I could see in pediatric patients was published by the NIH group. So Yates et al. Published a retrospective evaluation to look at long-term effects in CAR T and transplant in pediatric B cell ALL. So here we have 25 patients, median age is about 12. Long-term follow-up, or the median follow-up is about 7.3 years. They did not see any malignancies, and they did not also see any T-cell malignancies in these patients. But I should say they did see 12% of the patients had primary cancer that they could not correlate to CAR T. Now, we have to remember that 96% of these patients got allo-HCT post their CAR T. And so we cannot parse out what is causing these malignancies. There's another pediatric study that was about 478 patients. When they looked at them, and this is from the Real World Consortium, the malignancy rate was about 1.7%. So 7 patients developed malignancies. 3 were solid tumors, 4 were myeloid malignancies. Again, most of these patients had received transplant after CAR T and had part of their treatment included radiation. So again, we cannot say that these malignancies are all due to CAR T therapy, at least not in the pediatric population.
Absolutely. And I think you just highlight the need for continued survivorship, and whether that be a morphing of everything that already exists in that space into an independent guideline, or, you know, using what we have already established, especially since, as you pointed out, most patients are going on to transplant. You know, you have that established practice that we can, or you can pull from. And so with that, I would like to end by talking about future directions a little bit. So I think we can all agree, based off of the discussion, there is a big unmet need of CAR T therapy in pediatric patients. And really, for the sake of this podcast, when you think about it, we talked mainly about one product and mainly in one type of pediatric hematologic malignancy. And we know there's many more than that. But focusing on our discussion for today, what are some future strategies you see evolving to help address the unmet need in this patient population?
I think there are different things that are being tried. Mainly all is in the clinical trial space. One of them would be the timing of leukapheresis. And that is because you need your T cells when you collect them at their fittest. Because as you expose them to more chemotherapy, you lose those naive T cells, which are actually necessary for expansion and persistence. And so if you give more chemotherapy, the T cells that you're going to collect are not going to be as robust in proliferating. And so can we do leukapheresis earlier on in the sequence where we are treating them? There are no clinical trials that are supporting or that actually tell us that that is beneficial. The second is, do we need to wait to transplant them until we reach that second relapse or higher? Can we not relapse them? Can we not CAR-T them at the first relapse? And so there is limited data. I think there was a abstract published at ASCO in 2026, but there is a retrospective study that was published by Barsan et al. And this is, again, part of that pediatric real-world CAR consortium data. So again, median follow-up was 12 months, 185 children and children, adolescent, young adults. 36% of the 185 patients received CAR-T in their first relapse. The morphologic complete response rate was in 85%. I would like to have it been a little higher in the 90s. But if you look at their overall survival and event-free survival at 1 year, it was statistically comparable to the remaining patients who received their transplant at a second or later relapse. So again, this kind of answers, well, is there a benefit if the statistically the overall and event-free survival were comparable? Again, not a large patient population. But what was also interesting, because this may help us answer that question, is the toxicities. So any grade CRS, grade 3 or higher CRS, or any grade ICANS and grade 3 or higher ICANS was significantly higher or more in the first relapse patients compared to the second or subsequent. So the toxicities are significantly higher. And I don't think that the overall survival and event-free survival are that, if they're statistically comparable, then I would have expected them to be better to then risk having these toxicities. And I think it makes sense that the toxicities may be higher because there may be a higher tumor burden when you are in first relapse versus by the time you get to a second, third relapse, your bone marrow has been beaten down so much that probably the tumor burden is not as high, resulting in decreased toxicities. And so I think the COG trial, they have a phase 2 trial, AALL1721, that is actually looking at giving CAR T cell therapy upfront refractory patients, as well as high-risk patients who have poor outcomes in consolidation. So don't wait at the end of consolidation. If you are MRD positive by flow cytometry, then the goal is to take to CAR-T rather than try another chemotherapy regimen to put them in remission and then take to CAR-T. Then there are certain, another way to do this is, what are the mechanisms by which these, pesky leukemic blasts are escaping our CAR-T therapy? And there are a number. First, it may depend on your ability of those CAR-T cells to expand, their ability to actually be cytotoxic towards the leukemic cells, or it may be that they do not persist. And sometimes if you have received prior CD19 therapy, blinatumomab, you may actually have what is called a CD19 dim or CD19 negative relapse because you've already been exposed to CD19 therapy. And so in those strategies, dual targeting of antigens has been tried. So the other antigen to try is CD22, because about 60 to 90% of the malignant B cells will also express CD22 antigen. So you can do one of few things, co-infuse, give both CAR-Ts together. Now that asks for a lot of resources as well as time, because you literally are probably going to infuse two separate CAR-T products. Or you can do what is called as co-transduction, where it's a specific method of manufacturing your CAR T cells, where you're exposing them to multiple viral vectors, and then they're going to pick one and express it. So you will have a product that will have, if you're doing CD19, CD22, you'll have some CAR T cells that are specific to CD19 antigens, some to CD22. So when you infuse that, you will now target both CD19, CD22. So you at least don't, you that may solve the antigen escape problem for those two antigens. Doesn't mean, and of course they have to be both positive before you infuse the cells. There are, and I did look at some trials on clinicaltrials.gov, Visitronic CAR T cells, again, way of manufacturing CAR T cells where single vector encodes two separate CARs. So you want to have two antigen binding domains. So each transduced T cell is going to be able to target both antigens. Or you can do what is called as tandem CARs, where there is a single CAR molecule that is now able to bind to both the antigens on the same receptor. So these are all, you know, in different clinical trial phases, but there are other ways also to try to prevent. You can modify the single chain variable fragment. It is currently, TISA cell, it is murine. Another approach could be doing NK CAR, which we have at our institution, because the natural killer cells are able to recognize the malignant cells. They do not need to be sensitized prior to being administered, and they are antigen independent. So you don't have to, you know, that might be the best solution for antigen escape if it works. And then I think lastly, off-the-shelf allogeneic CAR T cells. So this would be, well, maybe akin to doing a small allo transplant. The advantages are that it's going to come from a different donor. So you don't have to worry about low number of lymphocytes. You don't have to worry about the disease being there while you're collecting. You don't have to worry about the T cells being exposed to, you know, lots of chemotherapy and not being fit to expand and proliferate. So those would be the advantages. Now, there is a big disadvantage is that these can also induce graft versus host disease. And so immunosuppression after CAR T at some point may be necessary to prevent graft versus host disease. Second thing you might have to worry about is just as similar to allo-HCT, where there is a risk of primary graft failure. You just don't engraft. So here you may also have the risk of immune-mediated rejection of this off-the-shelf CAR T cells. So lots of options. I haven't seen anything pan out to get FDA approval in pediatrics, at least.
Yeah, it sounds like there's a lot of exciting things on the horizon for both adults and pediatrics, and hopefully pediatric indications will start to grow similar to adults so that you have more, not just for the ALL patient population, like we mentioned, but, you know, all comers that will potentially benefit from CAR T therapy. And so with that, Vinita, I really want to thank you for your time and your expertise. This was a really comprehensive overview of, you know, what we know from clinical trial to now. And then I would also like to thank Cancer Network and Oncology on the Go for doing this collaborative podcast with us over at ASTCT Talks. So until the next one, thank you everyone for listening and for your time.
And I would be remiss if I didn't mention this, but there are CAR Ts in the works for solid tumors in pediatric patients. So CNS tumors, neuroblastoma, osteosarcoma, and then also AML. But they are at various stages of clinical trials. So, you know, eventually, maybe not in my lifetime as a pediatric pharmacist, but, you know, I'm hoping that some of these will come to FDA approval, not just in clinical trial phases.
We look forward to seeing that come to fruition as well. Thank you again, Vinita, for your time.
Thank you so much for hosting this and giving me this opportunity. So, well, have a really good day. Thank you.
Thank you for tuning into today's episode. We hope you found our discussions enlightening and relevant. offering you a deeper understanding of the present and future of cancer treatment and research. Make sure to join us again for more insightful episodes as we continue to bring you expert opinions and the latest developments from the forefront of oncology and hematology. Please subscribe and leave reviews wherever you get your podcasts, including Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and more. For additional resources and episodes, visit our websites at www.cancernetwork.com and www.astct.org.